Hey, folks.
Hey.
Hey. Welcome to episode 15 of Does It Matter?
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah. Like, we're coming in kind of hard. I just heard two Whitesnake songs on the radio.
Oh. Like, in a row?
No, on two different stations, actually. That's the weird part. I think they must be, like, touring or something, because otherwise that would never happen.
It could just be a really odd chance.
Day of Whitesnake. Robert Coverdale watches us from above.
As he always does.
So that's the beginning.
Yeah, we're keeping it loose this episode.
Yeah. I got up at 5 a.m. yesterday, and then I was like, I'm going to go to bed early, and then I didn't, and I've had 80 ounces of coffee today, so it's going to be a good one.
I'm not even getting it into, like, my caffeine amounts and my early mornings, like, bicycle riding 10 miles before work
Not
a fun way to start your day, especially since it adds an hour to your...
What time do you have to be at work?
At 8.
Oh, yeah, that sounds unpleasant.
Anyway, that's not the point of what we do here.
No.
What a weird window into our lives.
Yeah, just a little bit of background, you know, for... what's about to happen to your ears.
our topic this episode is world building.
Yes.
Which
I realized, like we always do, is actually pretty open-ended.
Yes. You know, I'll admit right now, I didn't even think about, like, other ways to interpret it. I really wanted to get into, like, my favorite examples of the way that people have constructed worlds for stories to take place in.
Okay. I'm very curious to hear what your examples are, because I know this is a topic near and dear to your heart.
Yeah, as a dungeon master, like, I have not opinions on how it should be done, but a fascination in how people do it. And sometimes when it comes out really weird, or, like, starts with a very bizarre premise, I'm just like, oh, well, let's see what happens now. And it's just the most fascinating thing. Because what if you could do that at a table with people?
You probably could.
It's
the thing about D&D is you can do just about anything with it.
Yeah.
I'm discovering this.
And you can make your own world that, like, transcends the other experiences. Oh my gosh.
That's a whole thing. At some point, we're probably just going to have to do a D&D-based episode.
Yeah, I was just thinking there's so much to say about D&D that I think the show needs to address.
Yeah. For those of you at home, listening at home, we have talked about, like, maybe once we wrap up this season, shifting the format around a little bit. So that could be an interesting way to...
Yeah.
An interesting, locus point around which to think of a new format?
Come to think of it, I could have been like, okay, so Player's Handbook is a book I would like to talk about. I might still do that.
Do you want to begin this week?
Sure, I can begin this week. Folks, I want to talk to you about a show that Alex suggested to me, and I started watching it, and it is now one of my favorite shows. It is called The Leftovers.
That's so good.
So basically, it's a 3-season show. It ran from 2014 to 2017 on HBO. It was based loosely on the first season of a book which Tom Perata wrote, also called The Leftovers. Tom Perata... the author of the book works as a writer on the show throughout its run, which is really
unusual.
Interesting. It's, yes, not only unusual, it helps keep a very genuine element to the way that the show progresses past the book. You can tell that, like, Perata's really still involved in it because it maintains...
a tone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely a tone. So the premise of the show gives most of the dramatic stakes. A mysterious event known as the Departure disappears 140 million people, which is 2% of the world's population. Where or why or how they have disappeared is unknown. but just about everybody claims to know some version of an answer.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's how you get started. I think it takes a moment. We should take a moment to stop and go like, wow, that's a really weird premise
with. Like it kind of was very evocative of the Left Behind series.
Right, but in
which, if you grew up in churches in the 80s, you know about.
Oh, we're the 2000s. They're still writing those books.
They're still doing that. Huh. Wasn't Nicolas Cage in, like, the Left Behind movie or something?
Yeah, they made one with, I want to say, Kirk Cameron, and it wasn't big enough, so they remade it with Nicolas Cage, hoping to get more views.
Because Nicolas Cage will do anything, and that's why he's great.
It is one of his many strengths.
Mm.
But yeah, it's a bonkers premise, and it's very ominous. It's
yeah.
Like, people just disappear, and it's just a couple people. I mean, not a couple people, but...
But not a huge segment of the population.
Like, one out of 50 people is not
it's
that
not
many.
There. Yeah.
I mean, like, the bubonic plague killed, like, a
way
lot
more
than that.
At least in Europe.
So, the world of the leftovers is defined by how the people still on Earth get by in the wake of the event. And that's the point, the reaction that people have. And for the first season, that's basically just watching people be really sad and not know what to do with themselves.
Yeah, like...
But it's really compelling.
It's... I don't know, when I watched it, I watched the first season with Kat, and she was just like, yeah, I'm not into this. It's like, I'm gonna watch the other two, and I did, and it's like, oh, yeah, okay. So the first season is really just table setting.
It is, which is interesting, because that's the book.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a sequel to the book.
But I kind of love that about it, though, because, like, the whole point of it is, like, you don't know. You're bumping up against the unexplained. It's not satisfactory. What do you do with that?
And they really... they work hard to never give you a satisfying answer to anything. Like, they do where they have to. But
only where they absolutely have to.
Yes. if that sounds like a fun show, you should watch it. Or if it sounds frustrating, maybe it's not for you.
Mm-hmm.
So the first minute or two of episode one takes place in the moments before the departure, but then everything is immediately dropped into 3 years later, and the world that has been created by 3 years of people trying to deal with this. So there are, of course, religious answers, ranging from the minister whose flock is on the wane, to those who believe themselves to have answers that no one has considered before, like Holy Wane, who hugs sadness out of people.
Oh, yeah.
But then there's the Guilty Remnant, a cult which spends all of its time dressed in white, stalking prospective recruits, chain-smoking, and reminding people that life is meaningless.
As far as cults go, get behind that one.
Yeah, I mean, they're on, like, Wild Wild Country territory
yeah.
at that point. Like, yeah, you've done some disagreeable things, but you seem generally on point.
Mm-hmm. I watched that, like, recently. That was fucking fascinating.
Not oh, isn't
off
it?
On a tangent, but just like, anyway, that's a whole... thing.
I bought a book by the Bhagwan.
Yeah, I realized that in my like pile of like weird shit that I have bought over the years, there's a little like fancy tea set with a bamboo mat and a book about like tea ceremonies, and it's by Osho.
Huh.
It's like, ah, I knew I heard that name somewhere.
That he's such an interesting... I don't understand him.
Yeah, and I do like how it goes out of the way to, like, not be about his doctrine at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We're going off on a cult tangent. Cults have invaded the podcast. Anyway.
Make a podcast-based cult. So there's also this fascinating way that the show handles government institutions.
Mm-hmm.
When it goes about, like, recreating the world... I mean, here's one example. The show turns arguably the main character, who's Kevin Garvey,
yes.
In the book, he's a businessman who is running for office. They change him in the show to be the chief of police. The first several episodes, he's butting heads with the mayor.
Yeah, of like a small upstate New York town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mapleton.
Yeah. Which is as small upstate New York town a name as you can get.
Yeah, isn't it? So they change him to the chief of police so that they can focus on how this small town actually deals with the fallout, spending time and resources just trying to keep citizens from losing it, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Like, Mapleton isn't filled with crimes. It's just his job to, like, keep the guilty remnant at bay and stop...
rowdy teenagers.
Right. Stuff like that. And replacing his crazy father.
Oh, yeah. Who is that? Was it, like, Lance Henriksen or somebody?
Oh, no. I just saw his name, like, yesterday, and I had never heard of him before.
He's... Oh, God. I can see his face. Who is he? He's in that not very good Zack Snyder movie, which I know doesn't narrow it down. Sucker Punch. The guy who's just like, and one more thing. It'll come to me. Anyway. Sorry. Like I said, I've had a lot of coffee today. It's tangent time.
You're good. So, more interesting to me is this department that they create called... this is like a government-sanctioned department.
Scott Glenn.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Anyway, go on.
It's called the Department of Sudden Departures, which investigates the event scientifically, and it also disperses money to the loved ones of the departed. My favorite character in the show... her name is Nora Durst. She works for the DSD, which is... and her job is determining who is falsifying claims of departures and who has actually disappeared.
Which, like, of course that would be a job. But that...
Yeah.
What do you do with that? Mm.
But the thing that's amazing about that is, like, it shows the way that the characters fit into the way that the world is built.
Mm-hmm.
Nora is sort of like an outcast in Mapleton because she was previously married with two kids, and even though it's almost statistically impossible, her husband and both of her children disappeared, leaving her alone. So her becoming an employee of the DSD is such
an baggage.
It has so much baggage, but it's a natural evolution and it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And it lends you insight into what the DSD is about when you look at her world. Possibly my favorite episode in the series is episode 6 of season 1. It's called Guest. It's when Nora goes to a DSD conference.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
It's one of the most interesting looks into the world of The Leftovers, just as far as, like, this is how people have dealt with moving on, and because really they're not moving on.
While we're on the subject of Nora, Carrie Coon is rapidly becoming an actress that's like, oh, you're in that? Okay, I'll watch it.
Yeah, I'm at that point right,
like,
now. I need to start looking more into what she's done.
Fargo season 3,
yes.
This.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, like, the two, but still. She showed up in Avengers, weirdly enough. Yeah. Like, as a, like, super gothy space villain fighting with Black Widow, and that's kind of about it, because there was way too much going on in that movie.
I'm going to have to see an Avengers movie.
It's fine. It's...
I'll do it for Carrie Coon.
Like, there's so many interesting actors in these movies and stuff, but yeah, anyway.
I think I've mostly talked about the first season at this point. Things get definitely weirder during the second and third seasons. Which really allows the world building to expand on the more existential elements of the departure. Basically, I'd say 75% of the cast of the first season moves to Texas.
Yeah, I remember that being like, wait, what the fuck?
And like, they don't tell you at the end of season one, and they don't tell you at the beginning of season two. Most of that first episode of season two is about the family they move in next to. So you're not really sure what's going on.
Yeah, they're really wrong if it's you.
So it's very weird that way. They're always keeping you, like, off kilter somehow.
Like, two and three are kind of in the same mode, but it shifts gears really hard from the opening credits out.
Yeah.
Very different theme song in season one than in the other two.
Oh, totally. The first one's this, like, epic orchestral thing.
Yeah, like
and
Max Richter score, like, with the big paintings and shit.
They're just, like, yeah, like, Sistine Chapel-style paintings of people, like, getting sucked up into the sky and screaming in agony.
A lot of whom are the cast, I think.
Yeah, they're, like, kind of the cast.
Kinda, yeah.
But then season two's, like, a kind of folky acoustic singer-songwriter girl.
Estimate.
Yes. Singing about how, why not just let the mystery be?
Mm.
And all of a sudden you're in Jardin, Texas.
It's like, this is the same show, right? Yeah, there's Justin Theroux, okay.
So the reason that they go to Jardin, and this actually makes a kind of weird backward sense. Jardin is a town where, again, almost statistically impossible, no one disappeared. So it has now been sort of informally renamed Miracle, and a bunch of people have moved to it, which is really difficult because everyone wants to live in Miracle.
There's like a giant hippie camp outside it.
Yeah, and they're all trying to get in, and it becomes this weird, like, community outside of the gate, and they kind of hate the people who get in, and it's such a vivid imagination of what would happen if everyone wanted to move somewhere in, like, a small town all at once.
Mm.
Like, what would happen? So, I'm sorry. Let me find my place in my notes. So in Jardin, we meet some highly idiosyncratic social and political structures which try to keep this supposed paradise functioning happily. But less concretely, Kevin begins to travel to the afterlife in the second season, and coming back. The afterlife kind of looks like a ritzy hotel.
I forgot about that.
And when you wake up, you're naked in a tub, and you get out, and there's four outfits in a closet, and depending on which one you put on, that's your goal, and if you achieve it, you can escape the afterlife. The first time he's there, he puts on, like, a really nice tailored suit, and it turns out that means he picked International Assassin. So he has to, like, act out an actual international assassin plot successfully.
Like you do.
And the next thing you know, he's clawing his way out of a grave. It's a weird show, you guys.
Yeah.
But, like, it all kind of makes sense in the world that they've written. And all of that ends up leading the minister that I mentioned, who moved to Jardin, he starts writing a gospel about Kevin.
Oh, since
yeah, Dr. Who. Yeah, Christopher Eccleston decides to write a gospel of his, like, kind of, like, brother-in-law-y friend guy.
Who is Kevin Garvey, by the way.
Yes. And again, this makes sense in the world of the show.
Like, Matt, the minister, he's such a fascinating character.
And he's so... Oh, the casino episode with him is just... so flawless. Like, the establishment shots of these characters are so powerful. I mean, like, who can forget Nora paying a prostitute to shoot her in a Kevlar vest?
Oh, yeah. That does kind of stand out.
Like with a gun. she's that screwed up. She just wants to be shot for fun.
Yeah, that's a... a pathology.
Also, towards the really, really the end of the show, Kevin's dad tries to prevent the apocalypse with indigenous Australian rain dancing, and then maybe someone ends up going to where the departed went? Maybe not? Maybe you'll have to watch?
I don't know.
I find it really interesting that this came to mind for world building, because for me, I mean, like, the characters of this show are hands down some of the most complex and interesting characters I've seen in television, and, like, I imagine reading about them, I would feel roughly the same way.
Mm. Yeah, I was curious to read the book.
As soon as I'm done with my summer reading list, it's, like, the first thing I'm gonna read. Just 12 more books. And the plotting is phenomenal. Like, there are half as many main storylines per season as there are episodes, which means by the time that you have watched each main storyline twice, they've all wrapped up. Like, it's so intricate, and it so so carefully follows the way that, like, the ripple effects of the world unfold.
Yeah.
But the world of The Leftovers is, like, still something that pops out as, like, oh, well, like, yes, The Leftovers would be a good example for world building, I think, because, I mean, it's, like, it's consistent, it's logical, it's meaningful, despite its over-the-topness.
Yeah, like, it's bizarre at the same time.
Like, if you can buy into what they're doing, they will never do something where you go, oh, that would not happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're always going to be right there with them in the thick of the weird.
It's like, yeah, I can see that. That's how someone would react to that.
Yeah, if I were in that situation that could never happen, that is what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, my last thing on The Leftovers, I just wanted to share... I write little notes to myself when I'm watching TV sometimes. It's just, like, a great line or, like, something I find really interesting. I found a note the other day when I was cleaning, and it was two things related to a single episode of The Leftovers. Right towards the end. This is in reference to that fact that someone is writing a gospel of Kevin's life. I was married to Kevin for 15 years. He used to look through all of our cabinets before he found the wine glasses. He has a tattoo that's misspelled, and he shits 4 times a day. So I refuse, Matt, that he's the goddamn second coming. And just the fact, like, not a quote here for the second one, just the fact that someone appears in the credits of that episode as Vigorous Hand Job Guy.
I do not remember that incident, but I love that credit.
So that's The Leftovers, and if you're not sold by now, then, like, I'm never gonna get to you.
Yeah, like, give it a try. It's an interesting one. Okay. So my first one, I also did a television show. And the way I approached this particular one was not necessarily going for, like, the most intense or the most interesting example of world building, because that would be really hard. And I didn't feel like it. So I picked ones that, like, have made a large sort of personal impact. So strap in, nerds, because I'm going to talk about some Star Trek. Specifically, I'm going to talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but I'm going to get to that in a second. The reason that I chose Star Trek for this is, like, this is a surprisingly big part of my childhood, and I think, like, looking back on it in particular, like, it was very formative about the kind of stories that I enjoy. And I will explain why in a bit. But, like, my mom was a big Star Trek fan. She watched the original series when she was a kid. Then we watched Next Generation, DS9, and Voyager when I was a kid. So, first, a little background in case you, like, are not a sci-fi fan or live under a rock or, you know, one of those things. So Star Trek was created by a dude named Gene Roddenberry in 1966. Roddenberry lived from 1921 to 1991. He was from Texas, but grew up in L.A., He was a combat pilot in World War II and flew for Pan Am. There's, like, this famous story of him, like, saving a bunch of people in a crash and shit. He joined the LAPD for a while, where he was a traffic officer for a bit, and then moved into basically, like, the public information department and ended up becoming the speechwriter for the chief.
Wow.
And that parlayed into becoming technical advisor on a show called Mr. District Attorney, which was a radio show that went on from 1939 to 1952. So basically, he kind of Jack Vincennes'd his way into television. We just watched LA Confidential, like, a little bit ago. So, like, that's a reference to that, if you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, which you probably don't.
Yeah, last episode, when it came up, you were like, if you haven't seen it, you gotta go see it. And then, when we were done recording, we went and seen it.
And watched it, yeah. And it's so good. Oh,
it
God.
Is. I watched it again, like, a week later.
Anyway. So Gene Roddenberry started writing for radio and TV. He started, like, submitting pilots and stuff, and, like, eventually got into some space shit. And sort of the things that he credited for filtering into what would become Star Trek were, like, old Horatio Hornblower stories, in which, like, a badass sea captain goes on adventures. Gulliver's Travels. These crazy worlds totally aren't social allegories. What? and wagon train style westerns, you know, to boldly go where no one has gone before, all that. So, like, those things kind of came together with, like, the science fiction boom in, like, the 50s and 60s, and that's whereby Star Trek was birthed. Since then, it has developed into a ton of shit. They're just looking at stuff that's on screen, ignoring the literally hundreds of novels, comic book adaptations, video games, etc., etc. There are 7 television series and 13 feature films. The television series are the original series, which ran from 1966 to 1969. And that's the one with, like, William Shatner and Kirk and Spock and all that shit. There was the animated series in 1973 and 74, which I've never seen, but I've seen screen caps of on the internet a lot, and it looks pretty damn funny. The Next Generation with, like, Patrick Stewart was from 87 to 94. DS9, which is the one I'm going to get into in a second, was from 1993 to 1999. Voyager was from 1995 to 2001. Enterprise, 2001 to 2005, and then Discovery premiered last year and is still going. And then the 13 feature films, you have Star Trek The Motion Picture, 1979, Wrath of Khan, 1982, Search for Spock, 1984, The Voyage Home, 1986, Final Frontier, 1989, Undiscovered Country, 1991, Generations, 1994, First Contact, 1996, Insurrection, 1998, Nemesis, 2002, the reboot of Star Trek with J.J. Abrams in 2009, the sequel to that, Into Darkness, 2013, and then the next one in that series, Beyond, 2016. I have not watched much Enterprise, and I haven't seen Discovery yet. I've seen all of the rest of it.
Wow.
So
that's some cred.
Yeah, I guess. Like I said, my mom was into it. 2 of the movies are pretty good. I would recommend Undiscovered Country and First Contact. Undiscovered Country is the Kirk and Spock group, and it's kind of like a noir thriller in space where, like, Kirk and McCoy basically get thrown into Klingon jail for killing an ambassador, and the rest of the crew has to solve the mystery. And First Contact is one of the ones where they travel back in time. One of the ones. In this case, they travel back to, like, when humanity first encountered the first alien species that we encountered, which was the Vulcans. And it's, like, helping James Cromwell do that. James Cromwell again. I like Confidential. He's in that, too. Anyway. The series that I want to talk about specifically, like I've said, is Deep Space Nine, which was 1993 to 1999. It was created by Rick Berman and Michael Piller, who were sort of took the reins of the Star Trek universe over from Gene Roddenberry when he was, you know, his health was ailing and he was getting older. DS9 is the first one that he did not have a direct hand in creating, although he knew about it and kind of gave them his blessing on the concept and everything. It ran for 7 seasons, total of 176 episodes. The main cast includes Avery Brooks, Renee Auberjonois, Terry Farrell, Armin Shimerman, Colm Meaney, Cyric Lofton, Alexander Sadig, Nana Visitor, Michael Dorn, and Nicole DeBoer. Of those names people might recognize from other things, Renee Auberjonois, I'm pretty sure it was the voice of the crab in The Little Mermaid. Armin Shimerman shows up in stuff. Colm Meaney plays an Irish gangster in at least a couple of things. Alexander Sadig was in Game of Thrones. He was like the Dornish guy's like brother, who was like the ruler of that place, for anybody who watches that. Yeah. Okay. What makes DS9 interesting, and the reason that I want to talk about it, is all the other series are ship-based. Like, this is a spaceship, and it flies around from planet to planet, encountering situations. Like, the original series and Next Generation are just kind of flying around the Alpha Quadrant, which is where we are, doing shit. Voyager, like, gets catapulted to the other side of the galaxy, and their whole thing is like, we're encountering a bunch of aliens humans have never seen before while we make our way home. That kind of thing. But it's very, like, to borrow a phrase from the X-Files, like, Monster of the Wiki in a lot of ways. It's like, okay, especially with the original series, like, we're going to address a particular social issue using this alien group as, you know, a concept or an example of, like, this episode's about racism. That sort of thing. The Next Generation gets a little bit more varied and subtle and interesting. Like, there's the one that I keep thinking of recently, like, especially in reference to meme culture, and I'm not the first person to make this connection, I can't take credit for this, but there's a great one where, like, they go to a planet, and the people on that planet communicate in historical references.
Okay.
So, like, Tanagra when the walls fell. but DS9 is different. DS9 takes place on a space station. And so it's kind of locked into this one physical environment. And what's interesting about that is they take a really interesting advantage of putting that physical environment kind of on the border between a lot of things. The situation is this space station is floating around a planet called Bajor, which has until very recently been under occupation by these, like, angry lizard aliens called the Cardassians. And it's a Cardassian space station.
Mm-hmm.
And so the political situation has shifted such that, you know, the Cardassian Empire, or whatever the hell they are, I forget, has, like, backed off, shrunk, etc. And so the Federation, which includes humans, Vulcans, kind of Klingons at this point, you know, all the supposedly friendly races, have come in, and they are, like, sort of working with the Bajorans, and it's like, hey, maybe you want to join us instead, wouldn't that be cool? And Bajor's like, maybe, you can hang out up there, that's fine, we're gonna have ambassadors up there, though, because we're kind of, like, freaked out about, you know, big governments trying to, like, take over our shit right now. So, like, you have that tension happening. You also have the fact that there happens to be a wormhole right next to this space station. And I can't remember if they know that when the series starts or if they discover that in the first episode. But it's there. It's, like, one of the few stable wormholes in the galaxy that has, like, consistent entry points at both ends, I guess. And it travels to the Delta Quadrant, whole different part of the galaxy. And so, like, you have this first sort of tentative exploration into this unexplored part of space. You get a little bit of that, but you also have that unexplored part of space exploring back, which comes into play, especially in the later seasons, where, like, there is this, you know, imperialistic force called the Dominion that exists on the other side that's like, hey, we conquer shit. Here's some new shit to conquer. Let's do that. So you get, like, four seasons of this epic war happening. And, like, it really plays with that concept a lot. There's, like, some weird religious tensions happening because the Bajorans worship these deities called the Prophets. And there are aliens in the wormhole who are kind of the inspiration, antecedent, etc. for the Prophets. And the captain of the space station, Benjamin Sisko is his name, gets contacted by these aliens in a way, and so, like, he becomes this, like, weirdly important religious figure on Bajor, even though he's, like, trying to manage the space station that's kind of run by the Federation and negotiating with Bajor. It puts them in, like, a really weird position. You have the Cardassians, who are, like, still around, and they're like, yeah, we used to, that's our thing. We low-key want it back. And, like, the Klingons are trying to get in on this shit, causing trouble in the Federation. Like, there's all sorts of, like, different forces pushing against each other. And, like, you see that in the cast as well. Like, you have the Federation people, like Benjamin Sisko, for example. You have all of that kind of thing. But then you have, like, Major Kira, Nana Visitor, who is a Bajoran representative whose, like, interests are kind of aligned with the Federation, but sometimes she wants to do other shit. You have, like, one of the most interesting characters in the show is Quark, who is a Ferengi. For people who don't know anything about Star Trek, Ferengis are, like, small, very large-eared, sharp-toothed aliens who are, like, hella about making money. Like, that's their thing. Their essentially religious text is called the Rules of Acquisition, which includes such gems as war is good for business, peace is good for business, etc. Always get contracts in writing, things like that. So, like, he's there, and, like, he is a civilian, he's not part of the Federation, and, like, he's, you know, kind of a little bit of a wannabe gangster, not really, but, you know, he tries. So, like, you have that kind of order chaos thing happening there. René Auberjonois plays Odo, who is a shape-shifting alien and the only one of his kind that he is aware of. So there's that whole fish-out-of-water story. He's the Spock Data of this series, because there's always that one character. Like, right. If you look back at the original series, Spock is actually the only alien in the main cast. Like, there's, you know, lots of Earth people, like, you have, you know, Sulu from Japan, Chekhov from Russia, Uhura's a black woman, but Spock's the only alien. And then, like, in the Next Generation, Data's a robot, or android, you know, robot, whatever. And he's, like, the only one, and that, like, that makes him weird, and so, like, he wants to be human, and that's, like, a whole thing, and, like, Odo fills that role in this one. What other fun stuff's going on? They do a lot of, like, fun running jokes and things. Like, Quark owns a bar, and there's a character in the bar named Morn, who's, like, a big, like, rock-looking guy, I don't know. Does not have a line in the entire series. Was, like, supposed to have a line in the first episode, and it got cut, and they just ran with that. So, like, the characters will occasionally make jokes about, like, how talkative or funny Morn is, but he never says anything. Stuff like that. They have a lot of fun with side characters. Gul Dukat, who is, like, a Cardassian commander, is, like, one of the most fascinating villains any Star Trek series has ever done. Like, you watch him through the course of the series just kind of, like, go totally off the rails, even for being a, quote, bad guy to begin with. You also have, like, another sort of favorite side character is a guy named Elam Garrick, who is a Cardassian, but he is just a, you know, simple tailor That's all. Definitely just a tailor. Not up to anything.
I believe you 100%.
Something that's also kind of unique about this one is there's a lot of child characters compared to other Star Trek series. Like, family interaction is kind of a bigger part of this, where, like, you have Quark's nephew and Ben Sisko's son are, like, friends, and they hang out and have plot lines. O'Brien has his family with him, and, like, that's a big part of his character and his storylines. And you kind of don't get that in other series as much. There's all kinds of, like, weird shadow organizations trying to, like, fuck with the situation. The MacQuest Section 31, Bajoran Intelligence, all that sort of stuff. It does the whole, like, castle storytelling very well. And, like, that's kind of the thrust of where what made me want to pick this, is it's, like, it's... I like the kind of story where you have, like, all these different interconnected forces kind of pushing against one another, and, like, what it's really about is that space where they all meet. I think Deadwood does a really great job of that as well, where, like, you have all these different motivations, all these different interests, all these different things just being thrown together into a cauldron and forced to deal with one another. And that does some fun things. One more note, just speaking of, like, the kind of weird interpersonal relationships that this has, there's a character named Jadzia Dax, who is a member of a species that lives with a symbiont. So, like, Captain Sisko knew Dax before Dax was in Jadzia. So, like, this young woman has the memories and some of the emotions of the old man that the symbiont used to live in. So, like, they hang out with each other, and, like, he calls her old man all the time, and it plays with things like that in fun ways.
That sounds... I know, I like that.
Okay.
So, yeah, man.
I hit the end of my notes.
Star Trek is a big one.
It is, and... I mean, that's just one series, and I've only tipped a toe into it. It's a lot.
Well, because it is so much a lot, I have never seen any of it. None of the movies, none of the shows. I saw, like, 15 minutes of one episode with my sister once. She's, like, super into The Next Generation.
I really like The Next Generation. It's maybe the best one... Especially at the beginning, it is hella 80s, though. So, like, if you're gonna watch it, you gotta be ready for that.
I mean... It's not... It's just... It's so much. Like, that's my only reason.
Yeah.
I feel like I wouldn't... Pardon me. I feel like I'm not culturally literate in a full sense. Like there's some big blips missing. Like, I've never seen a James Bond movie. I've seen, like, 4 episodes of The Simpsons. This thing with the Star Trek, like...
If you're gonna start with, like, if you want to dip your toe into that water, I would say DS9 is a good one to start with. Like, it's not... It doesn't have that, like, chronological inaccessibility that the original series and even the beginning of Next Generation have. Like, it's 90s TV, so, like, you kind of know what you're getting into. And the characters are all really interesting... It's one of the longer series. I think it might be the longest one, actually, but it's still really good.
Sweet. Well, I'm gonna stick with sci-fi. I want to talk about a sci-fi book called Nova. It came out in 1968. It was written by Samuel R. Delaney. I'm not gonna talk about him really at all. He's one of the most respected authors in sci-fi. Quite a few of his books, including Nova, appear on, like, those, like, top however many lists of books you have to read.
The canon.
Yes, the sci-fi canon includes Samuel R. Delaney. But Nova, because I mean, he's written a lot. I want to talk about Nova. It's dense and it is darkly colorful, while also still being made out of light. It's just like the Nova, which its plot chases. The plot is the simplest element of Nova, which doesn't necessarily make it simple. Basically, the year is 3172, and the Draco system, which includes Earth, and the Pleiades Federation are the main political and economic forces in the universe. Both want to have irons in the fire that is the newish outer colonies, which seem to be good sources of Illyrian, which is a component of space travel and terraforming.
So far, so Dune. Okay.
That's fair. So, a young, bold captain from the Pleiades, his name is Lork Von Ray, and a brash set of siblings from the Draco are locked in a struggle which involves family rivalries, intergalactic politics, and innumerable wealth, all of which is tied up in racing to an imploding and exploding sun.
Okay.
So that's the simple part.
Such as it is.
And it's also some of the basics of the world that you're in when you're in this book. It follows the captain from the Pleiades and his ragtag crew of literally whoever he could round up at a spaceport. Not a joke at all, that's his crew for the entire book.
Hey, you want to go on an adventure?
You look like you have cybernetics. You want to come pilot a ship with me?
I see you have a gun. I might need that.
Yeah. So the cast of characters is not overwhelming, but it is large enough to provide a variety of backgrounds, voices, and abilities to any scene with all of the crew involved. One of the things that you get, like, I mentioned voices of characters. Several of the characters have different accents, being from different corners of, not even the galaxy, the universe. And one of the dialects, and it's one that you get very quickly in the book and pretty routinely throughout, moves all of the verbs to the end of the sentence. So it comes out like, I once pretty good was, but a long time it is.
Yoda speech.
Yes, but before Yoda existed.
Right.
And it gets interesting with very long sentences, because, like, bad. All the verbs get moved to the end.
Oh, God.
They're just kind of kept in order.
Huh.
It's the best you get. So it's worth noting how different each of the characters actually is, as it reflects the plethora of worlds they are drawn from. There's the Mouse, a gypsy from Earth who navigates starships and plays the Syrinx. Syrinx is, like, essentially a flute of sorts that has a bunch of knobs and, like, pressure controls on it as well. And using all of the buttons, knobs, and the rest of it, and how he regulates his breath, he's able to create smells, sights, sounds, everything but physical sensation.
Hmm.
And so people who are really good with the Syrinx can provide an entire concert by themselves with, like, a light show and or, like, a music video or, like, whatever.
That sounds pretty sweet.
And it's hard to explain how that instrument would be captivating in a book.
Yeah.
But it still is. Like, every time it comes up, you're like, oh, wow. Because, I mean, his Delaney's description of it is just really on par with, like, what you would need to imagine it fully.
I always admire, like, a writer who can describe something like music very well.
Right.
That's hard. I know, like, we bumped up against that a little bit in doing this.
Yes. It's, I forget who said it. The music is better than words.
Something to Google.
I know that there's a Seth MacFarlane album with that name, but I know that he's drawing that as a quote from somebody. Anyway, so that's the mouse. Then there's Caton, who is an intellectual from Earth's moon, who's always lecturing or recording notes for a novel, which it's routinely noted in the book, oh, you're writing a novel? No one's written a novel in hundreds of years. At one point, they refer to it as an obsolete form.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. There's Caton. He actually provides a lot of exposition. Since he's always lecturing people, he'll tell a lot. He gives a lot of the information that is world built. And even though all of the characters around him dread him talking because it's just, oh, more dreadful lecturing, as a reader, you're like, oh my god, yes, more. Yeah. Tell me more.
I need this.
Especially since he's, like, a very eloquent lecturer. Like, he clearly is, like, he's well-spoken and he knows what he's talking about. He has, like, a fair bit of personality, like, added into it. It's fun.
Okay. You should have a podcast.
He should. So then there's Ty and Sebastian. They are a couple from the Pleiades Federation. They keep mysterious flying creatures as pets, and they read tarot cards.
Oh.
A note about that. Tarot cards are used to make major decisions in 3172. They've also changed what a couple of the cards are. According to the book, they were, like, lost to time for us and then corrected later.
Okay.
But it is an interesting world where, like, literally 99% of people have cybernetics and people are using tarot cards to make huge life-changing decisions.
I kind of like that. Like,
it's,
there's this, a rebellion against logic, which sounds worse than I mean it now that it's actually coming out of my mouth. I guess maybe a better way to put it would be an acknowledgement that, like, the logical and technological cannot encompass the entirety of experience.
Yes. That is I mean, honestly, like, there's no computer you can just type in, like, what am I supposed to do in this unwinnable situation, and it's going to give you an answer.
Dear computer, what is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Someday there will be a world where people do not finish that thought that way, but we don't live in it yet. Maybe in 3178.
Yeah, exactly. So finally, in the ragtag crew, there's Lincios and Idas. They are twins from the outer colonies who have spent most of their lives as indentured servants. You later find out that they are triplets. I don't know if... And I was thinking about this when I was writing. If you have triplets... And then you have two of them in a room and the other one's, like, off somewhere else.
Like,
do the two that you have, are those twins or are they triplets?
I mean, I think they're still triplets, but I've never seen that set up in a narrative or even real life either, for that matter.
Oh my god, I just realized something I have to talk about for final notes. That probably doesn't make sense, the way that it came out.
No, I think it makes sense. Actually, something occurred to me as well.
So the places that these characters come from inform their perspectives on the events and the people around them, but it's not the same as experiencing a world as Delaney actually writes it. New Brasilia, through a young Lork Von Rey's eyes, is electrifying and colorful, and you can feel... You know how when you look back at experiences when you were a kid, they feel more vivid than they probably were when they happened?
Mm-hmm.
You get that sense, like that oversaturation of meaning and memory while you're reading about this character's childhood. It's the most surreal experience I've had as a writer in a while. Where you really, like, your perception of things, like, you can tell it's being remembered and it's not being narrated.
Hmm.
I love that he's capable of doing that, and that's the way that you experience New Brasilia. This like really bizarre. I forget which planet it's on, but it's like supposed to be a recreation. They terraformed it to be like Brazil, and it's got Illyrian in the mines. And it just it's a very strange world, and you only get to see it like as this child. And it's different from the way that you get to see the other worlds in the...
I like, just hearing the description, it sounds like it would call it into question a little bit, even.
Yeah. it sort of does.
That sounds like a plot point, just, like, based on that reaction.
There's just so much going on, like... I part of the reason I want to talk about this book for world building is if I were to get into it on other terms, like to have to engage with like the full meaning of the narrative, I don't have that space. Like, this podcast does not have enough space
for that
element of Nova, but the world building I can talk about. So just a few more quick notes about places. Paris, imagined as a rich kid's party, like you get to see, is also an intoxicating. Like, you get the sort of like weird ebb and flow of like you're at a party and you've experienced too much of some substance. And is this really happening the way it seems like it's playing out?
Get your heart out, Jake Gatsby.
Oh God, yeah. Gatsby? What Gatsby? I won't say anything about the City of Dreadful Night, except to say that it actually lives up to the name.
That's great.
Part of the beauty of Nova is being whisked up and carried away by these, like, other worlds. But the greatest beauty is the solidity of the worlds. Caton's lectures lend so much reality to the novel that they read more as, like, yet unhappened history. Mm. I was recommended this book by a friend, and it sat on my desk for, like, 3 or 4 months, as all books must.
Yeah. There's an aging process.
And he just kept bugging me about it, and eventually I picked it up, and within the first 15 pages, I was like, this is different. And the thing that, honestly, like, this, I don't know if you get this. You find out that a piece of art was created by somebody at, like, a really young age.
Mm-hmm.
And you just get frustrated.
God.
Samuel Delaney wrote Nova at 25. I'm like, fuck you, man. You gonna do that to me right now? Like, in front of my friends?
We're so old. Yeah, I get that with music a lot. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm older than literally anyone in the 27 Club ever got.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Here we are.
No, that sounds really cool, though. Like, I'm going to have to add that to the 50-odd books on my list to read.
Yeah, let's start aging.
Exactly. You know, it's gotta ripen. Okay. Well, for my second thing, I decided to take the building part of world building a little more literally than perhaps other entries. Because what is interesting about this is not so much the storytelling aspect of it. Like, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's nothing, like, particularly special about it either. What makes it interesting is the actual physicality of it. And I am talking about the Dark Crystal. So, the Dark Crystal was a movie that came out in 1982, directed by one Jim Henson. So the story is, like, your kind of basic high fantasy setup. There's a magic crystal, it shatters, or at least a piece of it gets broken off, which splits these godlike beings, the Urskexis, into two aspects. You know, you have the, like, wise and gentle mystics, and then the cranky, angry Skeksis. The world kind of goes to shit. Native races, of which you really only get to see a couple in the movie, are either enslaved or wiped out, but, like, the last surviving Gelflings have to, like, go fix the crystal and save shit before, like, the stars align or whatever. You know, it's 80s high fantasy. Like, that's generic in the, you know, the literal meaning of the word. Like, that is a genre outline right there.
Yeah.
But what makes it cool, like, is it's the physical design sense, which comes down to the work primarily, I think, of two people. Jim Henson and Brian Froud. So, we'll talk about Jim Henson first, 1936 to 1990, creator of Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, you know, most famous for that. This guy is basically, like, the Shakespeare of puppets.
Yeah,
that's
a good way to put it.
Like, he, in particular, he pioneered the use of the camera in working with puppets. Like, he made filming puppets a thing, which it really was not, and, like, did that in a lot of really interesting ways. Like, innovated with materials and construction. There is, for example, the skin of Muppets is a particular kind of fleece. It's called Antron fleece. that is, like, made with a specific kind of density and composition, so that, like, it's uniformly flexible and hides seams very well. My girlfriend is a puppet maker. This is how I learn these things. But, like, these kind of innovations allowed for innovations in manipulation of puppets, and, like, the shit that they did with that is actually kind of mind-blowing. And in a way that I don't think, like, a lot of people really stop and think about. And the greatest example that I can think of that is from a Jim Henson movie that came out the year before The Dark Crystal, The Great Muppet Caper. There is a scene in The Great Muppet Caper where the cast of the Muppets are riding around a park on bicycles. This is not people in costumes, but they are full-body shots of puppets on bicycles. I don't know how they did that. I can't get my head around it. Just the logistics of having a puppet on a bicycle being able to take a turn that's not a person in a costume. How the fuck do you do that? Like, that is technically amazing.
I don't know if I believe that Jim Henson is dead, because he sounds like a lich.
Right? Like, and not just, like, what made him great was not just, like, these technical innovations, but also, like, he had this really, like, vaudevillian, ribald sense of humor about things, and, like, a really wonderful concept of the absurd. Where it, just, like, these surreal little touches. Like, it was a very, if you'll pardon the pun, gonzo sense of humor. So, like, you have kind of that filtered into this. And then on top of that, you have the work of Brian Froud, who is a kind of, maybe a little bit lesser known of a personality. He's, I think, most famous as a fantasy illustrator and for working with Jim Henson on The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth. He's British, he's born in 1947 in Winchester, credited on The Dark Crystal as a conceptual designer, kind of came up with sort of the looks of everything and all of that. If you think, like, that kind of, like, 80s British fantasy, like, when I say that, the image in your mind is probably something Brian Froud did. That sort of, like, there's a lot of, like, rounded edges and bright colors and filigree bits. And he wrote, like, or illustrated a couple of, like, books on fairies that, like, became sort of big things. His whole thing was, like, drawing heavily from British tradition and, like, the evocative feelings of the landscape around him. So you have these two people coming together to work on this thing, and it creates this world that is full of just, like, all these insane Baroque details. Like, you have the bird-like Skeksis. There's 10 of them, and each of them has a distinct costume full of, like, what was clearly, like, very elaborate and ornate and royal wear that has kind of fallen into disrepair. And just the look and the feel of each one, like, they have, like, names, designations, I guess. Like, there's the general and the chamberlain and the scientist, and, like, the scientist has, like, you know, bifocal lenses that are, like, actually two lenses, like, that those kind of old-timey glasses, like, he's got those. The chamberlain has, like, the big red robe, all of that. You have some amazing set design. Like, there's a character named Agra, who's, like, the mystical creature in possession of the crystal shard that the main character, Jen, the Gelfling, has to, like, go get so he can put it back in the crystal and fix shit. She has that, and she lives in a working orrery, which is one of my favorite words.
That's a good one.
It is. It is a dictionary moment here. An orrery is, like, a machine that depicts the movement of astral bodies. So, like, my other kind of touchstone for an orrery is Bugenhagen's lab in Final Fantasy VII. He's got one, too. But it's, like, this big, like, giant machine with a bunch of shit, like, whirling around, and, like, she's in there, and she's, like, you know, it's swinging around behind her, and she ducks under it as she's talking. You have, like, these giant stilted creatures that they ride on, the land striders. You have all these, like, there's a scene where Jen is, like, walking through some, like, natural space, and all these, like, tentacled plant animal things just, like, start, like, flipping out and hide in their little holes, and they all do it at once. The entrance to Agra's cave dealy is, like, guarded by, like, a semi-sentient vine that, like, grabs him, and then she's like, oh, put him down. And so, like, drops him. Like, it's what, like, it's full of all these great details, but, like, the real, what pushes it into that next level and what makes it really fascinating for me is, puppetry exists in a weird, uncanny valley. So, like, it allows you to do things that you can't necessarily do with just human actors in basic live action. But at the same time, it's more physical and tactile and concrete than animation would be. So doing something like high fantasy with puppetry puts it in a really neat space. Because, like, you have movies like Willow or Excalibur or Lady Hawk or Conan the Barbarian or Krull or Beastmaster, or not that I've watched any 80s fantasies movies. You know. It's definitely not my wheelhouse.
He wasn't even looking at his notes for that, you guys.
But, like, all of those, it's like, okay, that's a recognizable face. Like, yeah, there's Val Kilmer. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's Matthew Broderick in Lady Hawk for some reason.
Right?
Like, and, you know, okay, these are just, like, people in weird suits and shit. Like, there's this element of distance that happens where it's, like, it's trying to capture something fantastical, but in a way where, like, okay, I'm watching a movie, and there's a weird monster creature, but whatever, it's cool. But, like, with the Dark Crystal, it's, like, it's really taking advantage of that space that puppetry exists in, where, like, you believe that this is a fully functional world because it's got this consistent design that is not like anything that you would see just out and around you. And, like, I mean, I would kind of put it in a category with, like, that crazy ass, I think it's like Czech, yeah, Fantastic Planet. Or, you know, something like really kind of psychedelic like that. But again, it's got this physicality, this tactile quality where it's like, no, this is actually something moving in the world. It's not just an idea. And I don't know, I love the way that it does that, and I think that's what makes it stand out. Yeah.
Man, that's... I'm still taking some of that in. Okay. I'm ready. I can do this last example. This was kind of a weird one to figure out. I don't know about you, like, for me, if... I have some methods to figure out examples. I'm cluing you guys in behind the curtain right now.
Behind the scenes.
One of the first things I do is I go downstairs into the basement. I look at my bookcases. I look at the spine of every book, and I think, would this be a thing?
I do that with my movie shelves.
Right? I imagine you would. I unfortunately don't have that ability because I have a very small DVD collection.
Sure. But, I mean...
I go through my digital files sometimes.
Also, like, English degree, film degree.
this is very true. And then sometimes I come in and I'm just like, oh, do I need a video game? I'll scroll through my Steam library.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, does any of these work? It's tougher for the other ones. You just kind of have to, like music, I don't scroll through my music. I sit and think, like, what music...
Yeah.
Fulfills this. I do it backwards from the other ones.
Trying to scroll through a music library, just it's too much of a rabbit hole.
No, it would not. You know, it would not work.
Especially given the size of our respective libraries.
Yes. 40,000 albums or something.
Yeah. That's more than even I have.
So. The game. I was on Steam and I'm scrolling. I'm looking at the games and trying to think which one of these is going to be, like, a good response, and none of them looked good to me. Like, I was, like, I wasn't impressed by the world building, so I close it, and then the background on my computer, the desktop background, was from Bastion, and I was like, there we go! That's what I'm talking about! Thank you, fate!
Synchronicity.
My desktop background changes every 30 seconds, and it's pulled from, like, 300 different images.
Mm.
So, like, the odds are not great. But Bastion, yeah, I want to talk about Bastion. Bastion is a game that I love for its world building. It is also, ironically, a world destroying game. So, it came out in 2011. It came out from the studio Supergiant Games. It was their first game.
Yeah.
Two guys. Programmed almost all of it, and then they had a friend of theirs compose the score for it in a closet. They had all the narration also recorded in that closet.
It's such an interesting point in the evolution of video games,
mm-hmm.
where, like, you have these things that are, like, personal projects.
Well, the thing about Bastion was it came out and it, like, it took the video game world by storm. The whole, like, it won so many awards, won so many top tens. It was, and it was a small game, like, obviously. It was put on Steam and then, like, expanded out to PlayStation Network and Xbox Live Arcade. But, like, it was never bigger than that. Well, I'll just get into the notes. So you play as the Kid. That nickname is fitting for the world of Bastion, which is 50% recognizable as being of a vaguely bygone era, and 50% mystical fantasy that you've not quite seen the likes of.
Okay. I like that balance.
It's a good setup.
It's a good place to start. I feel like Ghibli hits that a lot.
This is like... not that far from like an action American version of a Ghibli movie, but like as a video game. I had to think about that for a second before I was willing to say it. I am. And I will probably be disagreed with by people. But like, remember, we're converting it to American and action. When I say that it's like 50% recognizable bygone and 50% like mythical stuff, I'm talking about the way that the weapons are modeled, the types of weapons that you get, talking about the buildings, which are all sort of architectured and modeled on like, oh yeah, that's like kind of somehow like I feel like I've seen in a history book, even though I obviously haven't. First off, here's the general plot. There's an event, it's called the Calamity. By the way, I did think it was really funny that I talked about the leftovers with the departure, and then now I'm talking about the Calamity.
From departure to calamity.
A mysterious event that no one knows the cause of.
Statistically impossible.
So the Calamity caused the game world to rupture. And much of the world that's left is, well, most of the world fell into oblivion, and the rest was kind of left floating for some reason.
Sure.
Yeah. It just tentatively hovers in place, and through that weird world, the kid makes his way through the instability to the Bastion, which is a kind of a failsafe and a power center. When he's there, he meets Rux. Rux narrates the game. Before I continue the plot, Rux is one of the best parts of this whole game. Like the narration, like okay, I got flustered. Logan Cunningham voices Rux, and he does a superb job of bringing to life not only the character, but the world. The thing about the narration in the game is that it's called dynamic narration. You do something, and then the narration happens.
Okay, so it like responds to you.
It does. So you fall off an edge, and Rux makes a comment about how the kid ain't too sure on his feet. You knock down a bunch of objects instead of progressing through the level, and he says, "Kid just rages for a while." That's a terrible impression of him, by the way. Not really trying very hard. So Rux directs every bit of characterization and exposition, which truly builds the world with his weird, gruff, gravelly words. Anyway, once you're at the Bastion and you meet Rux, you are tasked with finding cores which can rebuild the city. You then build the Bastion back to its former glory and explore more of what's left of the world. Filling out the world is a cast of bizarre enemies, all of which are kind of like cutesy but creepy. Like there's Squirts, which are like inverted teardrop shaped blue guys who come up and just like bite you to death.
That sounds unpleasant.
Then there's a, oh God, what are those called? Gas fellas. Really big guys. Every time you hit them, they get smaller. But they like slowly regain their size if you're not hitting them. They're dressed in like suspenders and. Like they almost look like the oh God, what is that called, that medicine? It has like the blue collar worker, whoever you're supposed to hate. Oh my God, it's the
Oh, like Mucinex?
Mucinex, that's right. Yeah, he like they dress like the Mucinex guy almost. And they've got like really like hollow dead eyes. They just constantly come at you, leaving this horrible trail of slime behind them. So yeah, it's full of like these bizarre enemies, a few other survivors with, of course, very tragic pasts,
sure.
And, of course, a socio-political struggle involving genocide.
Sounds like a good time.
You know, we're just trying to make sure we hit all the stops. The gameplay serves the world really well. The kid moves through throughout levels. It's mostly, like, a platforming and combat game.
I'm picturing in my head, and I don't know if this is the right game, like, a kid, like, wandering through a big, like, warehousey-looking place with a bunch of, like, dodging a bunch of spotlights.
No. Okay. This is, like, grassy bogs and, like, bizarre fantasy forests and, like, towns and like, cities that have fallen apart.
Okay. I'm into it.
I'll have to, after we're done recording, I want to show you, like, just a video of, like, some gameplay so that you get a feel for both the art style and the narration. Like, how it works. Oh my gosh, where am I in these stupid notes? Oh yes, so you attract debris to, like, continue edges from the platforms that you're on. You walk towards it and stuff will just rise to meet you. That's how you figure out where you're actually going. And it also helps, like, very carefully conceals parts of the level and lets you really explore them. Which is cool because you get to see a lot. I mean, you get to see every corner of these, like, lush environments that are, just really beautifully drawn. And, like, they hide, of course, power-ups and stuff, so you're rewarded that way as well.
Sure.
It's set on a twisted angle visually, which is great if you're using a joystick. If you're using a computer's WASD, pressing down makes you go down and to the right. Pressing up makes you go up and to the left.
I see.
So it's, like, kind of a weird, you have to get used to that, and it's not quite the same angle. Like, if you were to hold up and down, up and right at the same time, you would be slightly off from a path that's supposed to be going up and right. So, like, there's that one issue that I will complain about, because it makes it hard sometimes to appreciate the world building. But the way that it's set up, where it's on this, like, angle, where, like, you know, going up doesn't go up, it gives them more opportunity to present, like, really stunning environments that are, like, deliberately made for you to see from that angle. And I think it's worth the you know, the inconvenience.
UI
but,
difficulty.
Like, it... Oh my gosh, the art. Like... Not only are they creative with the way that the world comes together, but, like, the way that they put together the actual appearance of the world is just super impressive to me. So you get a little bit more about the gameplay. You get two weapons and a power-up, and you're just unleashed on what remains of the world. That's a really simple set of choices, just like the three things and you're done, which keeps the focus on the game world and the gameplay rather than the elaborate systems of character customization,
which is nice. Like, I love RPGs, but sometimes it's like, I just really want to press, like, two buttons, calm down.
Yeah, instead of that, it's just like there's, I think, 9 weapons or something like that, and you pick your two favorite as a combination. You pick one of, like, maybe 5 power-ups. Get to playing.
Nice.
Like, it's not... It doesn't have to be that hard. Because it doesn't need to be hard for this game. So I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the music. It really adds to the world because it's unlike... It was deliberately designed to be unlike music that you have heard before.
Mm.
And because of that, when it's presented with the world, it makes it seem like both of them are, like, a part of each other.
Okay.
The composer is named Darren Korb. That's K-O-R-B. And he composed a score for Bastion, which draws from both Old West-style, like, music and exotic-sounding Middle Eastern music. to create something that is at once familiar and unfamiliar. It's that thing they love to do.
Mm-hmm.
Korb himself calls this type of music acoustic frontier trip hop.
That does create an image.
It does. You would never guess. I love this score. I really cannot overstate it. I used it for an entire D&D campaign. The one that I did on the radio.
Oh, yeah?
Like, yeah. Most of the, like, incidental music was from this game because it... I mean, it's that perfect mix of, like, kind of... like old westy and kind of like exotic and like is that a theremin in there? Like what's going on?
I want a theremin so bad.
Oh, wouldn't it be fun? So all of Ruck's lines were actually recorded in the same closet that the score was recorded on. Anyway, the music is noteworthy because it's programmed dynamically. It naturally ebbs, flows, and changes depending on what you're doing, in a similar way to what the narration does. And it really adds a dimension to this bizarre idiosyncratic world that is Bastion. And I'm pretty sure Bastion costs like $5 at this point. It's been out for 7 years. If you have a computer or a PlayStation or an Xbox... get this game, it'll last you, like, at least 10 hours, and it is so replayable, and, I mean, like, honestly, there's plot twists that make you go, oh, holy shit. Like, I only talked about world building, really, but, like, there's any reason that you would be going to a video game, they made sure that you're going to be satisfied when you go. So, check out Bastion.
My last one is also a video game.
Oh.
It'll probably be pretty short, because, like, I don't have a lot to say about it, but I feel like when we talked about world building, this was, like, one of the first, like, reflexive thoughts that I had. So I was like, all right, I feel like I should go with it. It's a very silly game, but I love it, and I love the weird whimsy of it. And it's also very timely because it is about to get reissued, I believe, in September. Like, the whole, like, remaster thing, and I'm probably going to buy that. What I'm talking about is Spyro 2, Ripto's Rage.
Oh, Spyro!
So, like, the first game was fun. I liked it. The sequel, I have not played anything beyond the second one. I hear the third one is actually the best in the series. Just kind of, like, looking at, like, credible scores and stuff like that. And it's the whole trilogy that's going to be, like, reissued, so I'll probably end up buying that. But Spyro 2 came out in 1999. It was originally for the PlayStation 1, created by a team at Insomniac Games. And the plot is minimal. Basically, Spyro is a small purple dragon who, having recently saved the dragon world from a menace whereby other bigger, more impressive dragons were turned into crystals, he has decided to go on vacation, which, of course, you know, is never great for video game characters. See also Link's Awakening and Majora's Mask. Anyway, so he sort of gets shanghaied by a small furry mad scientist, a cheetah, and a fawn into helping them rid their world of a small angry lizard slash would-be conqueror named Ripto, hence Ripto's Rage. But it's a simple platformer, like basically your controls are run around, breathe fire, jump slash glide, and charge, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, simplicity. Ah, bless. But the way it's set up is there are three hub worlds, and then from each of these hub worlds, you have to, like, go through doorways into smaller worlds, whereby you have a main task to complete, and then a number of, like, side tasks that you can do in order to collect orbs that for some reason help you. It's not really very thoroughly explained, but that's not the point. But what I love about it is just the weird variety of, like, these worlds and tasks and things that you have to do. And I made a list of a few of them, and then, like, my iPad did something dumb, so I wrote a bunch of notes from work over it, so I'm going to, like, kind of try and read it here. So, among the things that you have to do include, helping a bunch of gem mining mice prepare for a disco dance, participating in a hockey game against a bunch of monks, saving baby turtles from the clutches of a soup chef, assisting some valley girl fawns in removing clay golems from their castle, participating in both sides of a battle between seagulls and slugs. Like, you kick a bunch of the slugs out of the seagull's harbor, but then you blow up a seagull munition building on behalf of the slugs. So, you know, kind of playing both sides of that one. You help a hedonistic hippo reach a berry bush beset by turban thieves. Having fun with alliteration there. Chill out a bunch of animals by turning on a magic fountain. Play exterminator for some country bumpkin farming robots. Fight off invading space cows and alien sheep from a city. Help a bunch of nerdy little squirrels. Fight off some giant Luddites and recover their light bulbs.
You know, I played Spyro 1, and I never went any further with it, because by the time that I could actually beat it, it was, like, over. Like, it was outdated.
Yeah.
And Spyro 1 was so tame compared to what you're talking about.
It really is. Like, Jesus. They go balls out in the second one, and I love it. Free some enslaved seahorses, put the kibosh on some rampaging tiki idols accidentally brought to life by magic. Collect party hats stolen by lava monsters.
I mean, is that like a walkthrough of the game, or is that like a greatest hits list of the weird stuff?
That's maybe 40 to 60% of quest objectives.
Holy cow, there's more!
Yeah, like I said, you go into the little world, and in each world, like, you have to collect a talisman, and in order to do that, you have to do one thing, but then as you're wandering through, other people will be like, hey, can you help me with this thing over here? And then you go do that, and it's all just, like, weird stuff, and, like, mostly it involves either, like, collect five of these, or, like, defeat this thing, or, you know, like, kind of standard video game platformer-style missions, but the skins that they put on them, the details are just so odd that I kind of, it's a fun world to get lost in, because, like, especially if you've never done it before, because it's like, well, what the hell's gonna happen here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, you're like the Valley Girl Fawns, I think, is my favorite one, because it's just like, you know, she's a fawn, she's chewing gum, has a yo-yo. It's like, so the Earthshapers totally, like, took over the castle. Can you help us out, little dragon man? Like, everybody has fun accents.
Of course they do.
It's just so, like, there's no logical consistency to it. There's no, like, underlying storytelling or, like, massive themes or anything. It's just fun.
It's the Mario Party of the Spyro series.
I guess. I haven't played the rest of them, but, like, I kind of want to now, especially, like, because I haven't thought about this game in quite a while,
mm-hmm.
but, like, it just popped into my head, and it's like, man, now I really want to, like, go back and replay that. So, a little bit of a lighter note, but...
Oh, no, that's a good thing.
Deserving of recognition.
Well, cool. That was a lot of ways. I mean, like, even though we didn't take, like, a broad approach to the world-building concept, I think that we got a very broad set of answers.
I think we did.
Which is exciting.
It is. It's fun.
Like, about...
Yeah, some space.
The Gospel of Kevin and...
Some dragons.
Sci-fi. Dragons.
Yeah. Sci-fi fantasy was definitely a theme here, which I guess makes sense with world building. Like, that's kind of speculative fiction's thing.
Well, good for us. There's, of course, at this point in the episode, two things. First, of course, we must figure out what we're doing next episode.
Yeah, hadn't really thought about that.
You know, I was thinking the logical, like, counterpart to the world-building episode is a character-building episode.
Okay.
Pick, like, examples of...
like, really fascinating characters.
Yeah, like, the most fascinating... character.
That's a tough one. Okay, yes, let's do that.
Characters. Okay, well, that was, I think, I want to say, literally the first time that I have come up with a topic. So I'm going to pat myself on the back. Okay, I can do it. That's exciting. And the second thing, the last thing we have to do,
cool
weekly
shit.
Recommendations.
Yeah, oh my god, I got a bunch.
I have one, so why don't you start?
Well, I want to make sure I'm not doubling up, so you should do yours first. Because we have been participating in some of the same media recently.
This is true. Okay, so I have two, and I'm going to keep both brief. One of them, check out the movie Three Identical Strangers.
I've heard that that's really good. I want
to
see it.
I want to say this as well about it. You're going to be tempted to look up what it is about, or listen to people when they tell you what it is about, or read the synopsis when it appears next to the title somewhere. Don't do it. Just don't. I will tell you this much. Triplets. That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know at all. Go in, sit down, watch the movie. It'll be great. It's gonna do the thing that good indie documentaries do. It's an indie documentary. If you like that kind of thing, then go watch Three Identical Strangers. Enjoy it. My other thing... just the song Gangnam Style.
It's 2018.
It is, but it has been stuck in my head for days, and...
It's a good song.
It is a political commentary in its original Korean, which I find great. And that's why I want to recommend it, is go and look up what it means and some of the symbolism that he's intentionally using. Psy has a degree in music from Berkeley, by the way. Like, when I say that there's, like, shit going on in this song, I'm not fucking around. It's a good song, it's really catchy, but, like, look up the lyrics. It's a critique of Hollywood. It's great. Check it out. I know that it's, like, way past...
Like, I would not have given it that much credit, but...
Well, okay, so two brief things about... They're not going to be brief, I'll be honest. Things about Gangnam Style. One, it appears in a weird Al polka that I have been listening to lately, and so for the last week, all I can hear when I'm not listening to music is... Hey, sexy lady. And that's, I would like, kind of weird and not fun, but... the fun thing is my brother got married in 2016.
Okay.
And at his wedding, the DJ played Gangnam Style.
Like you do.
It's like 3-4 years too late. But that's okay, I guess.
I mean,
at a wedding.
In my experience, that sounds like a wedding DJ, so.
So, you know, I thwarted his evil plan. My sister helped me. We got out on the dance floor, and we did the entire dance according to the music video. And the entire wedding watched us for the duration of the song. No one did anything. They just watched it happen.
I imagine nobody knew what to do.
I just pretended that no one was watching. And I kept... You know, you did that little, like, side thing. You do a little shimmy,
like,
you drag your foot.
Ugh,
so hard to pull off. Anyway, folks, those are the things I recommend. Take me seriously. What do you got going on?
Okay, well, I just watched the second seasons of Westworld and Legion back to back, so I am hella questioning reality.
Oh, I bet you are.
And would strongly recommend both of those. I agree with a comment that I think you said at some point where, like, the second season of Westworld is maybe not quite as good as the first season because they put themselves in this extended climax that they kind of had to see through.
Yeah.
Like, the first 7 episodes, I was like, yeah, all right, this is good. That's cool. Whatever. And then you get the episode about the Native American guy, and that's when it won me over. And then I think it ended very well.
Yeah.
And Legion is the most artistically interesting thing that has come out of Marvel Studios thus far.
Yeah, that's for sure.
The way I would describe it is, did you ever read Sandman?
No.
Okay. There's a scene in the first part of Sandman where Dream is like, he has to go to hell to collect some shit that got stolen by some demons and, you know, like you do. And so he has to challenge this demon for his shit back. And they decide to fight using the field of reality. And so, like, I forget exactly what the specifics are because it's been a while since I've read it, but it's something to the effect of, like, one guy goes, like, I am a bullet flying at you, and, you know, describes that for a second, and then the other guy goes, I am a bulletproof vest. I reflect the bullet off harmlessly. And, like, you know, they sort of conceptually argue about what they are that could challenge the other. And it's done in a really interesting way. And Legion is an entire TV series of that. Like, it's a show about people who are so psychically powerful that they kind of shape reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're watching it, you're never really sure what's happening. And then Dan Stevens and Jemaine Clement have a dance battle.
I had an experience watching Legion where I fell asleep at the end of one episode, and I figured I got close enough to the end that I didn't need to go back to see, like, the 2 minutes I missed. And I started the next episode, and all the characters were in a mental hospital, and it was, like, being over and over implied that they had always been there. And I was like, oh, this is the show that I'm watching now. Not realizing that, like, in those last 2 minutes, there had been a thing where they're like, oh, by the way, now he's, like, trapped in his own fantasy. And the fantasy was that they were in the... And so I spent, like... It took me until I got to the next season to be like, oh, so that whole thing wasn't real. Like, that...
I don't know what...
They told me it was a fantasy, like, but it was a fantasy. No!
Like, that's the thing. You're watching it, and you're like, I don't know how much, if any, of this is really happening. And that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. Also just started watching Barry. Oh god, I love it. That's all I'm gonna say about it for now because I haven't finished it yet. But the other thing, the last thing, I guess, because, like, there's... I could keep going, but the last thing, I watched a movie last night called The Lure. The story starts with the live band at a burlesque club getting a couple of mermaids a job. Most of the things that I've read about it describe it as a horror comedy. I would not necessarily call it either of those things, but it is a musical.
Oh.
And it's in Polish.
Other O.
It's on a register that is unlike most movies, so it's kind of, like, a little hard to get into if you're not, like, prepared for some wild-ass shit, but it's really fun. So, yeah, I would recommend that.
All right. That's 6 things for you to check out, folks.
Right.
Go
do your homework.
Yeah, you got 2 weeks until the next episode starts, so get to it.
Yeah. You will be graded on form and style.
Oh, yeah, also thanks for listening.
As always. And, yeah, pithy end quote.